The House Committee on Revenue for May 12, 2009 will come to order. Colleagues, I want to note that because of scheduling, we'll be ending the meeting at or before 9:30 this morning. And we'll open a public hearing on the bill that we carried over from yesterday, House Bill 2413. I think we have Representative Boone would like to be heard on that bill. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes, please come. Please. Mazin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, two members of the committee.
they'll be here.
I think it's one of the great things of for living in Oregon that you don't have to water your lawn until July. So
yes, and of course that's not germane, is
yes.
it? Back to the bill, please.
Back to the bill.
Trying to wait for your members, Mr. Chair, but that's
he's ad-libbing.
The House Bill 2413 we carried from yesterday, and what it does, it sets up council brain traumatic brain injury strategic partnership, and it puts the mechanism of funding this project, I guess, or the structure that it sets up from NDHS, the funding that is in front of you as a revenue committee is to designate $2 fee on traffic citation to fund these programs. That's where the funding mechanism that comes to this program. Then you have also in your packet both a fiscal impact and a revenue impact statement. This is criminal fees and assessment. The way they usually work is that they do have an amount that is attached to each citation or criminal fines, and those are distributed by statutes on percentages of how and where and when and which authority had this ticket. However, the $2, this is on top of each traffic citation, and just to keep a note, Mr. Chair, that this is an addition that judges usually have the discretion whether to levy this or not. So by doing that, it gets a little different that it's not every ticket that gets it. However, still estimating on the average, we're looking about $500,000 of biennium, starting a little less than that in the 2009-11, and growing a little until it's about $500,000 in the 13-15 biennium.
Thank you. Representative, thank you very much for being here this
morning. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, the beautiful Upper Left Coast. And I'm here today to support this bill, House Bill 2413, which establishes the Traumatic Brain Injury Council. You might know in my most recent past life, I've been since 1991, I believe it is, I've been a member of a volunteer fire department as an EMS person on the medical team. I don't do smoke and flames, mm-hmm. but I do a lot of trauma care. And I have seen a lot of accidents. We're on a high-speed highway, Highway 26.
Yes.
And but it doesn't seem to matter if you're going fast or slow. You can still have a traumatic brain injury. As a matter of fact, most of the TBIs hospitalizations are for older men and falls. And as we age, that is a big fear that people fall and they hit their head on something. The other top cause is motor vehicle crashes. This bill has kind of been a long time coming in that sense. The other, what we will be finding in the upcoming 2 years or more, returning troops from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and hopefully no other places, but war injuries, TBI is very, very common. And while other injuries can heal, this is one that often doesn't. And it changes people, it changes personalities. It's a long recovery, it's a long treatment, and there are all the ancillary issues attached to someone whose personality basically changes. And also not just personality, but needs in life. Some people to the point where they need to make a list just to get through the day. And this bill will create this council, and they will register people. I think it's the main job of it is going to be, especially at the first, is education and outreach. And the more people know, the better. I mean, I think it's going to have a lot of ancillary upticks to it, including encouraging people to use safety belts in cars and helmets while skiing. These are also sports injuries. Skiing, playing soccer, riding horses, a lot of the sports that schools sanction do require use of helmets now. So, and I won't take too much time to give you numbers because I don't think you'll do very well on the test afterwards, but there are, you know, strokes, brain aneurysm, brain tumors, falls, crashes, assaults, blasts, and that's the big one that the returning war veterans are experiencing. In our National Guard, we have, most of them have had this experience now, and some several times. So I think that, you know, when you get sent home from, say you have a car crash and you get sent home from the emergency department, watch what happens tonight. Don't let him fall asleep. He might have a concussion, whatever. There is a lot of it, I think, a lot of TBI that goes undiagnosed and people get up from an accident or something. My own father-in-law had a fall recently and was out all night and didn't come until the morning. And so, you know, when you ask someone who's fallen and has been unconscious or asleep if they hit their head, that's the first question we ask on a crash. Did you hit your head? And sometimes you can see a big starburst in the windshield and they go, oh, no, I'm fine. And they don't even know. So this is a good bill, and I guess my final piece is, having talked about the car crashes, a $2 fee or uptick on their fine from this. It doesn't cost our state anything. It costs the person who caused the crash or was in the accident, obviously caused the crash if they're being fined for it. This is a very small price for them to pay, especially if someone within that crash has been injured in this manner. So I think that you will find that this is a good nexus for the spending. It brings in enough money to do their program, and I really dread the numbers that we're going to see, especially with the returning veterans. So I hope you support this bill. Thank you very much. I hope you don't ask me any really tough questions, but I'm happy to try.
Well, we do have other witnesses. Are there any questions for Representative Boone? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much.
Thank you.
And I know you have another one this morning.
I do. So. I'll wait.
Thank you. We've signed up today, Tootie Smith, Sherry Stock, and Bob, it looks like, Jundep. Would you come forward? Is Ellie Jenny or Lisa Millett here? Okay, we'll call you in a minute. Thanks. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tootie Smith with the Brain Injury Association of Oregon.
And welcome back.
Thank you very much. We bring this bill to you to the revenue because we have worked very hard in trying to get treatment to people in Oregon with brain injuries. Oregon is one of the few states who does not have treatment, a sanctioned program through their states. This is a way that we can get the money, the treatment, the education, the facilitation down to the people who need it most. This is a very big problem in the state of Oregon. We estimate about 3,500 returning vets who will have some type of a percussion injury to the head who will need treatment and or assistance. This bill comes along with two other companion bills that have now passed the Senate. So one is scheduled for a hearing next Friday in the House Education. The other will go to Human Services. This bill is crucial, we feel, to the brain injury programs in Oregon. And with that in mind, I'm going to let Sherry Stock talk some more on this.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sherry Stock, and I'm the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. And basically what this bill would do, and Representative Boone talked about that, is create an advisory council made up of directors and high policy change makers throughout the DHS system and including the VA, mental health, seniors and people with disabilities. The Confederated Tribes, Native Americans, have the highest rate of brain injury of any ethnic group in the world. And we'll also have representatives from the active military. Oregon has one of the distinctions of being exclusively National Guard fighting in our wars right now. And many of them coming back with brain injury, at least 3,500 will be returning with brain injury. Since they are not a full-time military, they will not be getting the same services as full-time military.
That's true.
And so it's going to fall to the state to provide those services. And right now, the state does provide a lot of services to people with brain injury, including vocational rehabilitation, which covers them for cognitive rehab. And frequently, when we're not in an order of selection, which we are right now. And so what this will do is help bring brain injury to the forefront and have cross departments create programs to help people with brain injury get back to work, sustain a job, and pay taxes rather than being on the state system. The reason we are looking at traffic accidents is 49% of all severe brain injuries are from automobile accidents. And whether they're a pedestrian hit by a car or in a car, even a single car accident, they end up with a brain injury. And of those, they're the largest impact is from 15 to 34 years old, and that's the impact to the state, usually young males that are unable to return to work and they're getting on state services. So with this program, we're hoping that we can bring in enough money to get a return to work program going as one of the things that would be done with this to get people back into the work program. There is no cure for brain injury. One of the biggest helps that people with a brain injury and their families can have is support groups. So part of this bill also is support groups. The Brain Injury Association right now has 49 support groups throughout the state, but those are all volunteer. We'd like to have them a little bit stronger to really help people understand what they're going through and link them to community and state and federal services, which you don't know anything about a brain injury until you sustain one, and then it's all-consuming. How many Oregonians are affected? We have approximately 17,000 new brain injuries every year. 80% of those people are a mild brain injury, so it appears that they don't have any problems whatsoever. But then they start having problems at work. They might have problems at school. They will be labeled as behavioral problems. There's more fighting because they can't control their anger, which ends up back into the penal system. We deal with a lot of people. I get a lot of calls. I had two just on last week with people that have brain injuries coming out of the Oregon prison system, and they don't know where to put them because they do have a problem with their anger issues, and where do they go? And so a lot of this would be an educational base. It will also be looking for additional funding, whether it be federal or private foundation, to create additional services such as the TBI registry. That's something that we'd really like to see, and we'd really like to have that be sustained. And right now, we don't feel there's enough money coming in, projected to come in, to cover it under this grant, but we know, or this legislation. But we know that with funding, we could get this, and so we can tap into other funding. I think that's all.
If I could just add something. This bill also creates the Brain Injury Trust Fund as a set-aside monies and other funds, not general funds. We did that to try to protect it a little bit, to make sure that the money goes into what it's designed to do. That was, you know, one of the things that we fought hard to get, and through language in the bill. This bill has been amended many times. We've worked on it very hard to get to the point where we are today, because every time we tried to do something, another issue would pop up that had an adverse effect on something else. So we tried to write it and adjust it for the very little impact, financial impact on state services. This does create a 0.5 FTE in the DHS, which they can then get federal funds, a 2-to-1 match on their federal funds. And the Voc Rehab people are pretty excited about that, because they are wanting to work hard to make sure that these people are taken care of.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. Disability Rights Oregon, for those of you who don't know us, we're a nonprofit. We're sited in Portland, and we're funded primarily by the federal government to provide legal-based advocacy services to people with disabilities across the state. We've been in existence since 1977, funded to serve a broad range of people with disabilities, but in 2001, a new program was created on the federal level to provide funding strictly to advocate on behalf of people with traumatic brain injury. And it was, even though our organization had advocated, of course, for years for folks with TBI, this opened up a whole new world of learning for me, because we now became associated with national organizations and federal agencies that serve this population. I want to tell you very quickly a little bit about this and why this particular bill is so important. Traumatic brain injury is sort of the new disability on the block, if you will. While many of our more what I would call traditional disabilities, such as developmental or mental illness, of course, we've been aware of for years, the TBI has become a growing area of concern, because as medical technology has improved, more people are surviving. And so babies who fall off of their changing tables, toddlers who have falls, kids who fall off their bikes, young adults who drive their cars into other cars, and elders who suffer from falls. These folks who may have been very seriously disabled or died in the past are now becoming a greater part of our population, and of course, unfortunately, war veterans are swelling the ranks right now. And so this has been an area that has been one of great concern, growing concern, and it's caught the attention of other states and the federal government in recent years. It's a population that provides many challenges to serve, because folks who become disabled as a result of a brain injury, of course, have to negotiate their way through all of the aspects of life. So that involves school, it involves work, it involves staying in housing, being able to get benefits or income, interact with family and friends. It's a whole range of life skills that get affected by a brain injury, because people lose their memory, people have trouble controlling their behavior, people can have difficulties in communicating. And their disabilities oftentimes are very unique to that individual. It isn't it's not one of those situations where you've seen a brain injury and you identify it immediately, because it can be very different in very different people. So what I'm trying to convey to you is that this is a relatively new area. It's an area that has very unique challenges that are different than some of the other disabilities that we serve. And because of the nature of our service system, folks tend not to get the rehabilitation services that they need. They tend not to get the medical care that they need, and they fall into a system that's really designed for other folks, mostly seniors, so they can fall back into the nursing home system and other systems that do a pretty good job for the populations they're designed for, but not quite as good a job for people with brain injuries. So that's why we need a task force, a committee, to look carefully at this area as we move forward. It's going to be a growing problem for our state. And this is a good type of funding, I think, that given the situation that Oregon is in financially, this is a way that we can get going. And I think that over time it'll be a good investment for us. So I'm here to support 2413.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I have one, and it has to do with the bill itself. I'm looking at the first page of the bill. Do you have the bill in front of you? I'm looking at the first page of the bill. I'm looking at line 13 specifically, where the words language memory appear. It appears to me, looking at this, that this is an error, that in fact what you probably meant to say was B, language, C, memory, since of course memory is one of the huge effects of traumatic brain injury, and it's not listed anywhere else in the list of definitions. My guess is that the list got stuck together when it should have been separated. Would you take a look at that and see what you think?
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think this happened on the last amendment, so we'll have that corrected.
I see. It was corrected in the zero engrossed, but changed in the A engrossed. All right.
And you would catch that, being from your background, I'm aware.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Former Representative Smith is referring to the fact that, as a psychologist, one of the things that I did was a fair number of simple neuropsychological evaluations. I was never actually recognized as a neuropsychologist, but because of my background in assessment, the simpler forms of neuropsychological evaluation were among the things I did. And so the issues you're raising today I'm very familiar with, and of course the additional problem that we're having now with returning vets is a very big one. And I think the other key point you made, that often it's difficult for family members and employers and others to and even the person, the victim of a traumatic brain injury, him or herself, may not even be able to recognize what's happened to them, because the signs are sometimes very subtle at the beginning. Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. And we have Lisa Millett and Ellie Jenny. Morning.
Yes. I'm glad to be here. Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Ellie Jenny, and over 40 years ago, I was riding a bike long before there were pads and lights and helmets and all the things that have come more recently, and I was hit by a passing pickup and broke the headlight of the pickup out with the back part of my head and received a severe concussion and brain injury. And so I laugh when you say it's a relatively new field for me. It's very old. And I also received a spinal cord injury. And in my rehab, there was no focus on the head injury. There was focus on, learning how to live in a wheelchair and those kinds of things. But I basically had to teach myself how to get back and to do the things I'd planned to do. And I'm grateful for a mother that didn't buy into what doctors said, because I was unconscious for about a month, and I feel very grateful to have been able to regain what I have. And but the doctors wanted to put me in an institution, and my mother wouldn't let them do that, for which I'm grateful, because I fear if I'd been put in an institution, I would not have had the opportunities to develop and grow. I would have bought into the behavior of which I was surrounded. And I was able to put myself through undergraduate school with the help of Oak Rehab, and then graduate school and have a master's degree in counseling. And I'd love to go back and talk to those doctors and ask them just what kind of vegetable I was supposed to be. I'm very grateful that all the things worked together to help me become what I was able to become and not be institutionalized, but there were no services. And so I'm really grateful to hear that this bill is coming through and that Oregon is focusing on this, because it is a bigger issue than I think most of us realize. And until, you know, there is something, you know, functioning as some kind of body for folks to, you know, be registered with, I don't think we'll know just how big it is.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there questions for this witness? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your being here today and yesterday and your testimony. Thank you. With that, we'll... that's the last people... Is Lisa Millett here? No. Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2413. And open a public hearing on House Bill...
3472. Mr. Chair, Bill 3472 goes into the increases of the certain fees for business registry. Businesses do register with the Secretary of State. Most of these registration at this time are specified by law to be about $50 every time there is either new business for domestic or foreign LLC or any type of relationship in the registration of business with the Secretary of State. This $50 actually was the work of the 2005 session, what it previously was at $20, and to pay for costs. 30 of those $50 that exists today go to the general fund as a general fund for general government work. The bill in front of you is asking to change some of these business registrations. It levies a $75 fee for three types of the articles of incorporation and articles of organizations and the annual reports that comes from the domestic corporations. And in the case of the foreign corporations, this to be $150 for these types of transactions. In addition, this is what you have in your page 1, section 1. In addition to that, what the bill also does in your page 2, section 3, subsection 4, it also creates the and also dedicates, creates the technology fund for the Secretary of State, technology account, and dedicate six of these dollars that are being raised by these amounts to that technology amount, to that technology fund. That technology fund is supposed to do with the modernization of records and so on with from the Secretary of State, and that's probably why the bill would go from here to Ways and Means for those expenditures. On the Uniform Commercial Code, Section 5, it increases the fee from $10 to $15, and all that five additional dollars will go to that technology improvement or technology fund. Same thing with the Section 7 on page 3 with the notary commission. That also goes from $20 to $40, and all that amount of increase at $20 goes to the technology fund. And that's what the bill in front of you does, and we are still in the process of estimating exactly how much you would have at the end of the day.
Thank you very much. Representative Holvey, thank you for waiting this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm State Representative Paul Holvey from District 8, representing Eugene, Lorain Valley, and Bonita areas. I'm here to, and thank you very much for hearing this bill, House Bill 3472. I think, as you heard, this has to do with the essentially the business registration fees in the state of Oregon, as well as the Uniform Commercial Code and some notary fees as well. This bill is taking a look at those fees. When we look at other states, we find that Oregon is extremely low in the fees they charge for these types of filings. And, you know, we are in a time where we're struggling to maintain our services. And actually, one part of this bill I'm very excited about is the ability to create a better business registry online, sort of one-stop shopping for businesses to get registered, licensed, know what agencies they have to contact, all with one application, and being able to do that online as well is extremely exciting. I think it will provide a great service for businesses going forward. It's another, I guess, approach to how we deal with our state government. Instead of dealing with each agency individually, it's giving us an opportunity to use a multi-agency program. It's been sort of a theme for me this session, and I hope you give this bill some good consideration. The bill before you does raise these fees, and though the fees seem to go up and from the last raise, if you go back historically, these fees, as will be testified to later by Peter Threlkeld, who's sitting with me here from the Secretary of State's Corporation Division, they've historically been very high and have come down and then gone back up, then come down again. And so we are trying to put these registry fees sort of in line with other states. And I appreciate your consideration of this bill. I think it's something that needs to be looked at. It does help protect small business and entrepreneurs in that it doesn't adjust their fees as much. Actually, I don't think it does at all. And I think it's time the state of Oregon take a look at these fees and update them. I appreciate the attention that you give to this bill, and I'd like to turn it over to Peter Threlkeld for some specifics.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Peter Threlkeld. I'm the director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's Office. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 3472. The Corporation Division administers the state's business registration programs, our Uniform Commercial Code, or UCC programs, and the Notary Public Program. During the current biennium, our division will collect over $37 million in user fees that are paid by individuals and businesses to conduct transactions with our office. Out of that, over $22 million will be transferred to the State General Fund. We expect that those trends will continue in the next biennium. House Bill 3472 increases many of the fees that are charged to conduct business with us, and our estimate is that in the short biennium of 2009 and 11, we'll transfer an additional $9.5 million to the general fund. That will increase to about $10.9 million in 2011-13. Our office completed a survey of the fees charged by other states here in this last year, and there's an attached chart on the would be your third page that shows those fees that are collected by each state in the various programs, as well as some national averages that demonstrate that in many categories Oregon charges some of the lowest fees in the nation. I believe that if this bill were to pass, we'll still be toward the lower end and maybe to the middle of the pack in most all cases. The fees that we charge for Oregon corporations and limited liability companies whose owners benefit from limited personal and corporate liability as well as greater access to capital would increase from $50 to $75 per year. Fees charged to businesses that are formed outside of the state of Oregon would increase from $50 to $150 per year. And that is for their right to gain access to Oregon's marketplace and do business in Oregon. Historically, the fees that have charged, as Representative Holvey alluded to, were as high as $440 to apply for a foreign application for authority as a foreign corporation or foreign limited liability company to come into the state of Oregon and do business here. Then your annual fees or annual reports were $220 a year. So this is as recent as 2001. So even with the sharp fee increase to $150, they'll still be paying less than they did just a few years ago. Business corporations back in 2001 were paying $50 for their articles and $30, which is what they pay today. So they'll see a little bit of an increase. National average for these fees range from $46 to $937. There are a few states, Nevada in particular, that the upper end of their fees run $35,000 to form a corporation and up to $11,000 for your annual report based on your market capitalization. Many of the fees that are charged for starting and maintaining a business will go up. However, House Bill 3472 does protect Oregon's smallest businesses and entrepreneurs by retaining the current fee that's charged to register an assumed business name. You currently pay $50. It's a two-year term, so it works out to $25 a year, and this is to use a name other than your real and true name, which is where we see most of the smaller groups. It also protects our nonprofit corporations who will continue to pay the $50 annual fee. The other thing that it does is it protects Oregon's longstanding practice that sole proprietors and general partners who disclose their own name in their business, they have no registration requirements at all, and they pay no fee to the state other than any taxes that they would pay on business income or personal income. Our uniform commercial code filing fees would increase from $10 to $15. These are fees that are paid by creditors and secured parties when they file financing statements or other lien documents in order to establish their priority order as creditors in bankruptcy hearings. The fee last increased over 15 years ago, back in 1993. Nationally, the fees range from $15 per filing to $35 per filing, so we'll still be at the very low end. The fee charged to apply for a four-year notary public commission would increase from $20 to $40. This fee has not changed since 1989, which is over 20 years ago. Nationally, you're going to pay $33, and so we'll just be a little bit higher than that. One of the things that as we're asking businesses and to pay higher fees, one of the things that House Bill 3472 does is it sets aside a portion of that money to streamline government operations and reduce bureaucracy to make it easier for businesses to do business in the state of Oregon and with the state of Oregon as well as other levels of government. Part of the set-aside will be used to maintain and expand the state's central business registry. The Secretary of State led the charge on the central business registry. We brought the system up 2 years ago. A year ago, we expanded it to include registrations with Department of Employment and Department of Revenue. Our plans are to continue expanding that to include consumer and business services. We'd like to bring in state licensing agencies. We'd like to expand it out to local governments, counties and cities, as well as registrations that the business community has to do with the federal government at the IRS. Some of the other things that the system does is it provides information to the business to know what interactions they are required to do or available for them with government. Government provides many services to businesses. Economic Development Department is a good example where there may be grants or loan programs available, or training for doing international trade. The system, when you go into the system, you run through a wizard process. All you have to know is what business activity you're doing, where you're located, whether you're having employees or not, and how your business is going to be formed. And at the end of the session, you're going to get back a list of referrals and contacts to the different agencies that either you're required to register with, you're required to have some filing with, or that are going to provide other services for you. So we can expand this out so that if you need to be registered or licensed with the City of Portland or the City of Jackson County, that you'd be able to do so. So we set aside some money for that so that additional services can go back to the business community. So in the last 2 years, we've gone in my office from having no online registrations to now over 60% of all registrations come through the online system. So that's allowed us to reduce staff, helps keep our costs down, and instead of taking days and weeks to register a business, it now takes minutes and seconds. I'd like to thank you for allowing my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your business registry search, have you thought of expanding that search capability so that you could use zip code, for instance, to find businesses?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, we provide that service through our office. We have staff that have some more sophisticated tools. We're always looking for good suggestions, and
you
just gave me one. A lot of the best suggestions that we get are from individuals, the people that we deal with, and we've been very successful over the years at trying to expand those out. So I think that this ongoing funding would allow us to continue to do more of those types of services to make those online tools more valuable to the state and the business community.
Thank you.
Nice long answer to a very short question.
Yes, that particular process would allow you to find out where the registered agent for the business was pretty easily. Might not let you find the business, but a different issue. Other questions? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My guess is that many of us share the desire to ensure that Oregon is a place where businesses can start up easily and where there are few barriers to them establishing themselves here. With that in mind, is the increase in the filing fee, in your opinion, offset by the service that is provided in terms of enhanced centralization of these facilities and coordination?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bailey. Yeah, actually, I believe it is. Our office has been very successful at doing a lot with limited resources. And so while, you know, we're expecting that this would provide us with about $3 million a biennium in funding for technology projects, that really allows us to, you know, continue to grow and expand and offer more services online, which then creates more savings that we can turn right back around into providing even more services. So it does tend to grow and steamroll, and that's you know, what we hope to do.
And I might add to that, Mr. Chair and Representative Bailey, I think that $75 is you know, pretty cheap to do business in Oregon. And when you compare it to other states, you know we're well within the, as Mr. Threlkill mentioned, in the lower range still, even with that increase. And certainly, if a business can't afford $75, you know, for that, you kind of question their business model a little bit, maybe. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Vance.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I was hoping you would weigh in.
Yes. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious. The testimony, Mr. Rockell, indicates that while increasing fees for starting and maintaining a business corporation, a limited liability company protects Oregon's smallest business enterprises by retaining the current fee for using an assumed business name, a nonprofit corporation. Do you have something that would suggest that the smallest businesses don't use limited liability company formats? Do you have a study or something that would give us that data?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, not a specific study, just more anecdotal evidence, years of dealing with the businesses. Just there's a lot of the small mom and pop businesses, you know, for whatever reason, they don't need, or they determine they don't need the additional overhead, the additional access to capital, or limited liability that would come with an LLC. So we do see, we have right now probably our biggest chunk of registrations is assumed business names. We have about 145,000 of those, whereas we may have 120,000 limited liability companies or and about 110,000 corporations.
In the 32 years of my law practice, I don't see too many assumed business names, but that's probably because they don't need any help filing them. I form an awful lot of LLCs and partnerships and small corporations that are very small businesses, and they want the limited liability that goes with the device, or they want simply the organizational structure that goes with the extraordinarily simple arrangement that an LLC constitutes. So I would have to suggest that the assumed business name and the LLC now are almost interchangeable, mainly because of the extraordinarily low cost of the LLC as a device. Now, so I would have to challenge this portion of the of your thought that it's a bigger business that is usually an LLC. I would suggest that in my experience, but perhaps it's based upon being from a small rural area where most businesses are economically challenged. But I would just have to say that most of the businesses I've seen with LLCs are small. Is that your thought?
And I guess, I mean, I have to agree in many respects that, you know, the studies from the Small Business Administration and other groups, you know, that they really identify 96% to 98% of all Oregon businesses as small businesses. So, you know, we certainly have a lot that go into the LLC category. There's a lot of attractive benefits for someone to form an LLC. When you look at the limited liability protection that you get for paying an extra, essentially an extra $25 a year, there's, you couldn't buy insurance to protect your home and your personal property for that. So there's just a great deal of benefit for someone to do so. So yeah, I believe it would be very attractive for even the smallest businesses to organize that way. It's just in our experience, a lot of people, and maybe they're less sophisticated, or they just really want to be a sole proprietor or a general partner, that tend to use the assumed business name.
Yes, Representative.
I'm interested in knowing why the value of limited liability should accrue to the state. That seems to be implicit in your thought, and I really don't know why that would be true, but tell me your thinking on it.
I know.
Of course, that's a policy question that you may or may not want to answer. It's definitely a kind of question a committee needs to deal with.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, you know, the formation of limited liability companies does provide, it's statutorily set up in the state of Oregon, that does provide many benefits to these businesses. And as you may know or remember, I've also tried to deal with some issues where we have limited liability companies from around the world forming businesses here in Oregon because of how cheap they are, and their our lack of information that we get from them has been actually a matter of concern to the Department of Justice, the FBI, and many others. That we have shell corporations existing in Oregon for many purposes. And, you know, the fact that $75 to do business in the state of Oregon for an LLC, large or small, seems to me to be quite a bargain to operate in the state of Oregon with some of the benefits that we do provide.
Was there testimony, has there been testimony today on the point you just made involving the formation or perpetuation of corporations for uses other than legitimate business? I think that's the point you're making now. And how does this bill address that issue?
This bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill does not address that issue. That was a separate bill that went to judiciary and actually is being reviewed by the Oregon Law Commission at this time. And as well as it's being reviewed at the national level, so that bill is in a holding pattern as such. But it still is a matter of concern, and especially I believe Oregon has become a haven for this sort of illicit business activity and formation. And I think that Peter Threlkill may want to correct me on that, but I believe that Oregon is second only to Delaware in the formation, according to the FBI, of shell corporations that have been a great concern to them and their inability to track them. Raising these fees a little bit won't stop that, but it certainly won't be the cheapest in the nation. But we're still at the low end, and I guess the real point of this bill is not particularly that, but the point is that, you know, the state of Oregon provides services. We're looking at providing some great services for economic development, making the ease of getting licenses and the efficiency of that for businesses, and the timeliness of being able to get that done from the state of Oregon, providing that to businesses is worth something. And, $75, I believe, if you look at the charts, is still a great bargain.
Thank you. Representative, I interrupted you. Did you have more questions?
No, I had one
follow-up. Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to get to that point of the service that you just described as compared to the benefits of just being in Oregon. And I'm curious how much of the proposed increase goes to the services provided by the Secretary of State's office on the one hand, and how much goes someplace else. In looking at this, it appeared that there's an assumption that 30% or some number, $30, will go to the general fund and not to the department. Thus, the argument that this is a fee for a service and is going to pay for the service is weakened dramatically. Am I reading the bill correctly?
Well, I think you are to some degree, but I think the $30 is current. That's what happens now. But there is an additional amount that goes to the general fund, and You know, I believe there are services that the state of Oregon provides businesses in an ongoing basis as well. I mean, any time they go to a court, they have costs. The courts obtain costs from that. Any kind of filings, and I think this bill sort of addresses some of those things. Certainly, there is an amount of services that's provided through the general fund.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. Currently, the fee increase that went into effect in 2004 did create essentially a $30 surcharge. The fee went to $50 from $20. The Secretary of State continued to operate on the $20 charge, and $30 is siphoned off every month and transferred to the general fund. In addition to that, every fiscal year end, we transfer any excess revenue down to basically 2 months of operating expense. So we'll go down to $500,000 or $600,000. And I believe in this current biennium, we've transferred, our fiscal year-end transfers were about $4 million total. The total transfer this biennium is going to be $22 million that comes from the user fees and is transferred over to the general fund.
And, Mr. Chair, I just might add that this is not considered in the pure sense a fee increase. If you look, the bill does require a three-fifths majority because it is revenue-raising.
Right. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to isolate that piece of it, which part of that which we're now asking, or now what we're being asked to approve, is going to help pay for the service rendered, and which part is going to the general fund. And then I was trying to look for that justification piece, that is, what is it that allows us then to place this burden upon these businesses? Is it, as you say, Representative, that the folks who have these businesses are enjoying an unfair advantage because they're not paying as much as someone in some other state, or is it because they can, or what is it that supports the payment of an amount over and above the value of the service being provided and being paid for in some other part of the fee? That's what's most interesting to me. And I know that's squarely in the policy area, so you don't have to answer, but the justification for that over and above part of what's being asked for today is what I'm interested in.
Yeah, that's a great policy debate. I would argue that Oregon is a better place to do business than California, Nevada, or Washington, and our fees should reflect that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Madison.
Representative Benz, just to explain the details a little bit, and this is not to delve into the policy at all. As it exists today, the fee for registering a business is $50. $30 of those is already going to the general fund. What this bill does increases several things and maintains that $30 that goes to the general fund as only $30 that goes to the general fund. So the three-fifths majority requirement for the increase is not for the money that goes to the general fund. This is already existing. The three-fifths majority increase is for the rest of the $75 and the $150 and the other amounts that go or designated to the technology account. And the rest of it, which is not specified here, so that the $75... $30 continues going to the general fund, $20 continues going to operating fund, $6 go to the technology account. And that leaves an amount of money that is going to, it would be general operation of the Secretary of State's office. So that amount would be subject to the end of the biennium kind of estimation of how much the costs are, and then the transfer that occurs at the end of the biennium to the general fund. But in that sense, there is a budget item that, because this is continuously approved, has to be limited to by the Ways and Means Committee.
Yes, this bill doesn't have a subsequent on it already, but it if the committee decided to pass it out, it would have to have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, even though it's not on it now, because there's at least two or three different functions that are definitely ways and means functions in the bill. Other questions now for this, for these two? Representative Holby, Mr. Threlkeld, thank you very much for your attendance today. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3472. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2873. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2873 deals with an issue that the committee discussed in the 07 session, and it is relates to the local income taxation of retirement benefits. And the issue came to a head when Multnomah County had their three-year temporary income tax from 2003 to 2005. And the situation that arose was that PERS and federal income was exempt from the tax, but non-PERS retirement plan income was taxed. So you have the A engrossed version of the bill in your packet, and you have a dash A2 amendment. And what the dash A2 does, well, what the bill does is it provides that all retirement benefits are exempt. That makes the non-PERS retirement benefits exempt. The dash A2 makes all of the non-PERS benefits exempt before the effective date of the act. So it gets at this, it goes from a different treatment to a same treatment, where the original bill would make them tax exempt both backwards and forwards, and the dash A2 would make them both taxable moving forwards after the effective date of the act.
So both of these would treat retirement benefits the same, but would have the opposite effect after for earnings into the retirement account after the effective date of the act.
Yes, there are two ways of getting at similar identical treatment for all these benefits.
I read the A2 amendment, and I didn't get that point, but I appreciate that is in fact what it says. Representative Barker, thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you.
Waiting patiently through those other two bills.
I'm waiting more patiently probably than the people I was supposed to meet in the last hour, but thank you, Mr. Chair. And with me is Joe Gray, who's a retired Portland firefighter and past president of the Portland Firefighter Retirees. This came about because when Multnomah County passed the tax, people, a mailman could move from Minnesota after he retired to Oregon and not pay the tax. A firefighter or a police officer employed by the Portland Fire Bureau or the Police Bureau had to pay the tax to retirees. And we had people who were PERS employees who worked side by side with us, rode the same fire rig, rode the same police car, who didn't have to pay the tax, and the guy sitting next to him did. This makes it fair. The amendment says from this date forward, everybody pays the tax on benefits created after this bill. We're fine with that. We just ask for equal treatment. That's the short version. If you'd like a longer version, Mr. Gray's prepared with a 45-minute speech.
And I think that we might forego that.
Okay.
Could you describe just a little bit the 45 minutes? A shorter one would be fine. Mr. Gray, would you like to be heard? Has he described the situation pretty well? Or?
Well, yes.
And for the record, would you state your name again, please?
Joe Gray, with Portland Retired Firefighters. And Mr. Chair and committee, situation in our particular bureau, for instance, and we're basically the only ones that this bill deals with. We have a situation where about a third of our firefighters are under PERS now, and we have what we call the last man's club. All new hires are all under PERS. So we have a situation where we have only those people that are fire and police under the fire and police pension fund are being taxed. The person they work with who is under PERS is not being taxed. And so what we're trying to do is to get to even that situation out. So we're talking about a very limited number of people. So that's.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Call.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, and maybe this is a question for Chris, is there any local jurisdiction in the state right now that currently has an income tax?
Currently there is no
local income tax. Okay, just wondering.
Right. Let me make just a respond to that question as well. This issue has come up in Multnomah County in connection with the tax that they formerly had that expired. It came up also in Lane County in connection with an election having to do with the establishment of an income tax, where one of the issues in the debate over whether or not the tax should be approved by the voters was the reality that under the law, the PERS pensions and federal pensions were exempt from the tax. And I think that a number of voters, based on the campaign at least, and the fact that those who opposed the tax were successful in killing it, my belief is that that was one of the reasons why the income tax was defeated, because they thought that some of the better off retired folks in the county were going to be able to avoid paying it. Now, because of the constitutional issues around, the contract issues around pensions and the issues involving the federal pension versus state pension problems that where we lost in court on that issue a number of years ago, we cannot simply change the law today to allow local jurisdictions to tax PERS and federal pensions. What we can do is apply a rule that says after the effective date of the bill or any other date we choose in the future, all future payments into those accounts will be subject to a different rule, and that is that they are available to be taxed under an income tax by a local jurisdiction. Now, if I describe that accurately, and of course, I'm one of those people who believes if you can't fix something today, at least get it fixed for the future. So that when the next time something like this comes up, if it ever does, the local jurisdiction will be able to say, well, yeah, some of the old ones are not taxable because of the old lawsuit, but the newer ones are because the rule got changed. And this may have no effect for years and years and years, and then it may be valuable at some time in the future. And that's the reason that I proposed the Dash 2 amendment. And I'm very pleased to hear that this was acceptable to Representative Barker. Any other questions on this? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2873.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll open the public hearing on our last bill of the day, House Bill 3485.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3485 does a few things relating to biomass. First, it expands the existing biomass producer collector tax credit to include transporters of woody biomass. It also creates a tax credit for biomass electrical generation and requires the electricity to be generated by a facility in Oregon that uses only biomass. And the credit is based on the amount of electricity generated from the biomass facility. Currently in the bill, there are a number of blanks referring to credit levels and so forth. It also creates a tax credit for expenses related to the purchase of equipment used to collect or process waste materials or used to manufacture a product from waste materials. It requires the taxpayer to be the owner of the equipment. And the amount of the credit is equal to the cost of the equipment, but not greater than the liability of the taxpayer. And lastly, the bill would require the Department of Energy to conduct a study of biomass facility sites in Oregon and report back to the legislature by February 1, 2011.
Thank you. And before Representative Thompson gets started, I want to find out if there's anyone here who has signed up to testify on the bill who would have a great difficulty returning tomorrow. All right. Would you come up and sit next to Representative Thompson, and we'll hear you next. Please.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Vance, Vice Chair Bailey, For the record, I'm Jim Thompson, state representative from House District 23 in the West Valley. About 50% of my district is devoted to forest biomass production, as is the case in a number of yours. The biomass industry is a fledgling industry in Oregon. It hits its up and downs based on market forces and a number of other things. But it's something that I don't think we can ignore in our immediate future for a number of reasons, environmental as well as economic. There are essentially three portions of this industry that we have to deal with, and they're dealt with in this bill in different ways, some of it in existing statute. First is the harvest on-site of the biomass material and preparation of that material on-site for whatever use it's going to be put to. Second is a transportation component to move it from the production site to a utilization site. And thirdly, then, is the utilization. This particular bill looks at energy generation as a primary aspect, but this also fits well with cellulosic biofuels production. The first two components would be the same. And it could also apply to any other purpose for which we can develop a use for forest biomass materials, not exclusive of simple things like mulch. As our mill industry adjusts to a different future, we're going to have a big shortage of bark dust in here in our area, and some of this forest mulch could be diverted to that, although that's not as environmentally sound as some of the others. The biomass power industry provides a number of environmental and social benefits in addition to the production of electricity that exceed the benefits provided by any other form of renewable energy. These benefits are provided because the biomass industry, far more than the electric power industry, is a waste management industry. Benefits include, among others, air quality improvements, reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, lessening of burdens on landfills, lessening of forest wildfire risk, and provision of rural jobs in numbers far in excess of traditional power technologies. If you look at the last page of your handout, I'm not going to go through that handout today for sake of time, but there's a lot of information in there you might want to look at later, and I'd be glad to talk to you individually. As a typical 30-megawatt wind farm employs five workers, receives $1.6 million in production tax credits, which is about $320,000 per employee. A typical 30-megawatt biopower plant will employ about 120 workers in plant and outside, receive $2.2 million in production tax credits, which is about $18,000 per employee. So much more efficient on the employee level than other options. In past years, various mechanisms for recognition of the intrinsic value of renewable energy in a regulated utility environment were used. These mechanisms allowed the biomass industry to establish a foothold and construct biomass power plants nationwide that sell electricity into the consumer power grid. We had a few here, but not many in our state. But now electricity production is deregulated in much of the country, and nothing counts except lowest price per kilowatt hour, which makes it very difficult for biomass to compete directly. In this situation, biomass power cannot compete and face a distinct possibility of going out of business if we don't find some way to support it in its infancy and get it to a more mature platform. Millions of tons of urban generated wood waste will again be sent to landfills. Remember, this isn't just biomass. Wood biomass is wood biomass. It could be a ground-up old house, or it can be forest-harvested. Anything that has that base on it will work in this particular thing. So we're very concerned in this state, as you all know, about what's happening to our landfills, or lack thereof. Sawmill wastes are also in danger of being landfilled. Let me remind you, it wasn't that long ago that virtually all of the waste from sawmills was either sent to landfills or it was burned in open fires. It took a long time in the environmental movement to generate uses for that and get it recycled into the economy. And that's kind of where we are today. We need to extend that to keep this from reversing itself. And just as a reminder of how important this kind of approach is, I see this as a jobs bill, but it's also an environmental bill. Right now, we're using federal stimulus money to clear forests in southern Oregon and eastern Oregon, and we're stacking and burning the biomass that we collect from those sites. 500 acres of juniper is being cleared right now in eastern Oregon. That material is being stacked and burned for no economic or environmental benefit. So we can intercede very quickly and make something happen in that arena. I'll stop here because I know there are people behind me that want to testify. And again, I urge you to look over that handout we provided, and please contact me if you need any further explanation on that. And Dylan Ammo in my office is the biomass guru for our operation. You may talk to him too. I have to beat it off to another meeting, but he'll be here for the rest of the testimony.
Thank you very much. And gentlemen, I'll ask you to take 3 minutes each, so we'll have a couple of minutes for questions. We're going to adjourn at 9:30, and committee, we're going to convene tomorrow at 8:30. And because this bill has a number of others who would like to be heard, we will be carrying it over to tomorrow, House Bill 3485. Please.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Joshua Ferguson. I live in Dundee, and I am the chairperson of an alternative fuel advocacy group called Bumper Fuel. I believe 3485 is an important bill that must pass Oregon to help us become energy independent. According to a report written late last year from the National Priorities Project, the United States is spending between $97 and $215 billion annually on military action to defend access to oil and natural gas reserves around the globe. Oregonians alone will spend $834.1 million in 2009 for the military to secure foreign petroleum. We need to refocus our money and effort on renewable energies that cause less harm to land and the people around us. HB 3485 allows us to not only refocus our financial and human capital to more positive energy product, it also allows us to start that transition from gasoline to environmentally friendly and renewable ethanol. Did any of you know that during World War II, the federal government had picked Springfield, Oregon as a site for a cellulosic ethanol plant? Imagine what our world would be like if they had followed through with it. Yes, we would have gone through a time of finding a balance between cutting down trees and making fuel, which I know here in Oregon we can do. But in the end, vehicles would be emitting 90% less greenhouse gases, and $0 would have been spent, along with zero lives lost, making sure we had our energy needs. I'm going to skip a little here. Let's talk about perspective of what this fuel means to the individual Oregonians. If cellulosic ethanol was used in a Suburban, it would emit it would use 10.7 barrels of oil at 2 points and emit 2.6 tons of greenhouse gases over 15,000 miles. A Toyota Prius using gasoline over that same period or miles would use 11.9 barrels of oil and emit 6.4 tons of greenhouse gas. In other words, the Suburban would use less oil and emit a third of the gas. This is exactly what us rural people need, is a fuel that allows us to be as environmentally friendly as a Prius without having to give up the things that we need to make ends meet. It also helps those of low income. Low-income families cannot afford a $20,000 Prius or Insight, and by the time any hybrid or electric vehicle becomes useful, it needs batteries. $2,500 is not in the budget for most low-income families. Cellulosic ethanol or flex fuel vehicles are available at low cost and are a good alternative for families, as you know. So now let's consider jobs in Oregon.
Okay, and would you wrap up, please?
Okay. It is a step in the right direction. It does reduce our greenhouse emissions, reduces our cost to get and produce energy, and allows us to bring kids home from foreign lands so we can get the works produced. The part I missed, one of these plants will employ up to 250 people. That alone will help bring us the money that we need and help our economy recover.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
I'm Jim Fairchild, Mayor of the City of Dallas, and I'm going to skip over. I'm going to give you a little bit of history about our roller coaster on the forest products and how that we've lived and died and come back again and then died again, as you know, fairly recently, again on the timber products. This one right here is a way of bringing this, letting us continue our history as far as the timber project. Probably the most important thing is I just returned last week. I sit on the National League of Cities Community and Economic Development Committee. We were in Savannah, Georgia. We spent a whole afternoon on biomass and the importance of biomass, how it does this. A gentleman by the name of Russ Harding, a senior advisory for the Herdy Advanced Materials Development Center, who specializes, promoted by the Georgia Pine Corporation and that. What they discussed on basically biomass and what its value is going to be in the future. I see what you have in front of you right now as a first step. That this right here is going to go and be the biomass I see in the future is probably we're just looking at the tip of the iceberg. Below that is a whole bunch of things. We spend our time on research and development, and I would urge you to perhaps as you go forward in other areas to look at research and development. Biomass right now is and also some incentives to create this. Biomass right now is the way, like I say, it's a step in the right direction. I see practically no negative as far as from the cities. It is something where the rural area has material sitting right there. We can use them. We can also use existing facilities, such as the Weyerhaeuser plant that is now being mothballed. And so this would be a step, we feel, in the right direction. Finally, Mr. Harding, when he was pointing out, showed two areas that are very strong biomass-producing areas. One was the Georgia area, and then the other was the coastal and down the Willamette Valley because of the warmth and the amount of rain and this sort of thing. And at that point here, I'll go and step back and have questions.
Thank you. That was very good. Are there questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. one of the things that Representative Thompson talked about was helping this fledgling industry get started until it matures. And that's one of the things that worries me about this kind of credit is that once the industry does mature, we don't stop. We keep on giving them the credit after they need it. And I think we need to be very careful about that.
Thank you. Other questions for these two? I'm assuming that other witnesses will give us more background and detail on the bill when we reopen the hearing tomorrow after 8:30. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for your attendance today, and we appreciate your being able to be here. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3485. And have I given the notices I need to? I think I have, yes. All right, and we'll adjourn. See you all tomorrow at 8:30.